Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The basketball hoop in Ben's apartment. The open floor plan of Composure magazine. The flowers on flowers on flowers on flowers that decorates Michelle's apartment. We meet Andy in white with a blonde halo of wisps of hair around her head. We meet Ben in all black leather and a helmet that covers his whole face. These are some of the components of design in How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Who decided that Bebe Neuwirth wears kimono-inspired dresses throughout the film? Who decided that there would be a pool table in the middle of Ben's office and that the paint on the walls would match it? Was it someone's job to make sure that the handwriting on the chalkboard that tracks the BS game is a little smudged from the years of play? And what do each of these items mean? I know jockey guys who love sports, and none of them have decorative basketball hoops in their apartments that are oddly placed over breakable items. This is not meant to be realistic, and yet I immediately know what the movie is trying to tell me about Ben with that basketball hoop. These are some of the questions that I am hoping that Stuart Blatt will answer for us today. Stuart is a production designer who has worked in the trade for over 30 years. He has designed shows like Angel, Criminal Minds, and is now the production designer on SEAL Team. I'm Vanessa Zoltan, and this is Hot and Bothered, How to Production Design.
Hi, Stuart.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Things are good here in Los Angeles.
I'm from there.
You are? From where?
I'm from Van Nuys, born and raised.
Well, I'm right now sitting in my office in Studio City, so not very far from...
Not far at all. A couple of stops just east on the 101.
Exactly.
That made me happy. Okay, so obviously being from Los Angeles, I came out of the womb with all of this information, and I'm just going to play the dummy so that people at home can follow along. But
why not?
What is production design?
Well, in a nutshell, production design is taking the 2D and making it 3D. We'll get a script. We'll get the written pages. We'll get the words, the book of words, as we call it. And it might say Chinese restaurant or hair salon. And it's up to my job as a designer to create that world, to create that real three-dimensional world and give the actors and the director a playground into which they can now infuse the energy of their scene. And quite often it's just really a placeholder. The word cafe is a placeholder. The word Italian restaurant is a placeholder. It doesn't have to be a cafe or an Italian restaurant. And then quite often it's my job to interpret that as to, all right, what would you like to see in there? Would you like some kind of trendy, cool, hipster hotspot? Or do you want something a little more old world familial? That's where I come in, is creating that world that then becomes visually what the viewer sees.
So what does the process of production design entail? Like if I wrote a script and I said college apartment, would it be up to you what photos would be on the wall or if there's like a whiteboard with messages on it? You know, what does that process look like?
the production designer is the head of the art department, and I have a big crew that's working underneath me. And it's a benign dictatorship. I mean, I want everybody's ideas, and eventually the buck has to stop with me because somebody's got to be the final word.
Right.
But pretty much the way you can break down design in film or television is the production designer is the general contractor. Mm-hmm. And it's the overall vision. I'll work with the writers and the producer and sometimes the director to come up with this cohesive look that's going to help them tell the story. I design the sets and my crew builds the sets. The set decorator and their crew, they bring all the decorations in. So I might build the four walls of this dorm room, and then he or she, their team, brings in all the decorations in that, with the kind of bed, the kind of posters, the kind of whiteboard, the kind of Keurig or the TV or whatever. And the prop master then brings in whatever the actors touch and play with. So if the actor is writing a term paper and laying on their bed, he'll bring in the books and the pens and whatever. And it's very much a sort of symbiotic, collaborative relationship that all has to be worked together. So a lot of times they'll come to me and say, I'm thinking of using these things. Are you okay with that? Because I know you have an overall general look. And usually we all then meet in the middle and have an agreement of like, yeah, that'll work great. That'll work great. I'd rather not go with that because that might take the viewer's mind away from something. If you put something, a shiny object in the corner that isn't supposed to have attention called to itself, and all of a sudden the viewer just keeps looking to the corner and keeps looking. So they're taken out of the scene. Mm-hmm. So you try and get your crew and your collaborative team on the same page as soon as possible. So everybody's not fighting different visions. And, you know, the old adage of a picture's worth a thousand words. Well, it's really worth thousands and thousands of words, because you could say to me, oh, hipster coffee shop. And in my mind, it might be one thing. In your mind's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
So what everybody brings to a project is a combination of their own personal life experiences. So it's always great to hear what someone else thinks something else might be.
Yeah.
And then, you know, eventually we mold it all together and it becomes usually one cohesive unit.
Yeah. So if I am sitting at home watching a movie, how would I know that the production value, the production design is good?
Good is subjective.
Sure. But you've got an opinion.
But I do have an opinion. I have lots of them. If you can help further the story and not detract from the story, that's good production design. Mm-hmm. If I'm not helping tell the story, then I'm really not helping the project at all. I'm just sort of designing for my own ego.
Yeah.
And that doesn't help anybody. So when you're watching a project, you know, whether it be the Gilmore Girls or whether it be Game of Thrones, you want to be immersed into a world that you don't have to think about where am I or what's going on, or I have to take a level of disbelief to understand what's going on. You want to just say, okay, I'm here. I'm here in a small town in America. I'm here in a crazy world and far off wherever Game of Thrones took place. So the idea of creating a believable environment that the audience doesn't have to fight their brain to figure out where they are and to work hard at accepting the reality. You know, you put yourself in there and then the story moves along smoothly.
I have one more collaboration question before I move us to the classic film, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. And that is, so how much do you converse with someone like the costume designer? So like, this might actually be a great transition question to How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Would the person who dresses Ben be like, okay, this is the kind of t-shirt this guy has. This is the kind of shirt he wears. That means his taste is probably like this and his apartment might look like this.
You know what? So many people work in different ways and there's different collaborative processes. Quite often my conversations with the costume designer on the TV show that I'm working on kind of tend towards, they'll say, hey, what color are you doing for the apartment? Or what's the tone of the bar? Because I want to make aprons or t-shirts or I want to, and they want to make sure we're not clashing or we're not really fighting against each other. And so there's not always very deep conversations, but we're all part of a team.
Yeah.
And so I might say to, like, Robin, who's our costume designer on this show, Robin West, who's fantastic, I might say, hey, you know what? We're going to be doing this bar and it's going to be a sort of a cowboy bar. Could you make sure that at least 20% of the patrons are in Wrangler wear or whatever? You know, I tend to try and not get in their rice bowl too often.
Sure.
It's their world to create. And likewise, I'm not looking for them to help me create my worlds. But it is a relationship Now, I did a movie years ago called The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit, which is a really great, fun family movie. A story about these guys that pool together the last $20 each to buy a vanilla white ice cream suit. The movie takes place over the course of 24 hours, where they each wear the suit for an hour, and all these magical things happen. And so one of the things we tried to do with the costume designer and myself is try and avoid white anywhere in the movie except for the suit. So the suit was really special. And so that was a collaborative thing with this designer named Marie France, is that I was very conscious of that in my sets. She was conscious of that with the other people's costumes, so that when the white suit was around, the white suit really stood out. And so that was a real collaboration with that in mind.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of collaboration. And if you're working with people who get along, there can be an incredible amount of very, very fun collaboration. And at the end of the day, you, of course, you want to produce something, I keep using the word cohesive, it's cohesive visual project where nothing stands out. Because one of the things, as being a designer, I've always said is the greatest compliment in some respects is for people to walk into a set or a location and not think we did anything because it looks exactly real.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is the curse. You're just like, what? I want some attaboys. I want some kudos.
Yeah.
I want people to say, wow, this is amazing. But then again, you also want them to say, yeah, I get it. It's a Thai embassy, or it's a the Syrian safe house, or it's whatever. You know, just, of course it exists there. Right, a couple of days ago, it was just a pile of wood. So you are always looking for that balance of people saying, everybody looks fantastic, or, hey, yeah, sure, they, of course they look fantastic, because why wouldn't they look fantastic?
Right. Okay, so how to lose a guy in 10 days.
Okay.
You have designed a lot of office spaces in your work.
Mm-hmm.
There are two main office spaces in this film. What did you notice in these two office spaces of Composure Magazine and this ad agency?
Well, it's funny that you asked me that question, because that was going to be the very specific points I was going to make in our conversation. Now, I happen to just see this movie for the first time. I guess I'm late
to
the game.
You did it for me, by the way, everyone.
I did it for you.
You're a nice man.
I watched it last night for you. And what I found really interesting, and this is exactly, comes back to the point of saying, helping build a character and further tell a story and remind the audience where you are without having to remind them to show a sign all the time. Showing a sign of a business, or showing the stationery on the logo or whatever, is a tried and true way of setting the scene and letting the viewer know where we are again. But, you know, how many times can you do that over a course of a movie that's an hour and 37 minutes or whatever? So you always want to find more interesting ways. And the one thing specifically that jumped out of me last night while I was watching this is that in the Composure Magazine world, everything was light and bright and soft and cheery. There were curves. The windows were big arches and curves, very female shapes. And the computers were white, big white monitors on the desk when we first come into the show. And when you get to Matthew McConaughey's office, it's dark. It's hunter green. There's dark wood. There's horizontal blinds, very linear, very horizontal and vertical, whereas her office was very round and, like I say, the female shapes. So right away, you have a contrast. That was the one thing that jumped out at me quickly at the movie last night, is that, wow, okay, we've set up two worlds, not combative, but contrasting worlds that let the audience know exactly where they were going to be and exactly kind of what characters you're going to meet. And that's one of the hallmarks of a rom-com, of a romantic comedy, is that you're not taxing the viewer, as opposed to, let's say, something like Oppenheimer or Poor Things, which is combative with its design. It's spectacular, but combative. It wants you to think. It wants you to know what's going on. It wants you to sort of draw conclusions or realize why certain scenes are taking place there and make you ill at ease sometimes. Rom-coms are generally bright, are generally soft, are generally pleasing. It's like delicious vanilla ice cream. And the only one interior location that was even made you just was, and I forget the character's name, Catherine Hahn's character.
Michelle.
And her apartment with all the sort of Laura Ashley and Lily Pulitzer and all the sort of shabby chic, which at first could become, oh, she's got a shabby chic couch, or she's got some beautiful soft chenille, whatever. You start to look around, it's like, oh, wait, there's print on top of print on top of print. And it's like, okay, this is a complicated character. And she was the complicated character. Yeah. She had a lot of shit going on. As charming and funny as it was definitely a look into her personality.
Yeah.
Which I loved, which I thought was fantastic.
I love Michelle's apartment. When you start paying attention to how everything is a flower, it's like, oh gosh, like that cup is a flower. Everything is a flower.
It's one of the amazing things they're doing on the show, Only Murders in the Building. And a friend of mine happens to be the set decorator on that. And I've heard him talk about all the different, what they call Easter eggs. I don't know if you know what the Easter eggs are in design, where they hide little things. All the little Easter eggs they're putting into their sets. And they're so visually exciting. And at the surface, you're like, hey, this is great. And they're fun and weird and they're offbeat. And then you're like, oh, wait a second. What's that back in that corner? Oh, what's that? You know, 90% of the audience never sees that. And that's fine. Because as long as it doesn't detract from the story, you are cluing the viewers in, the ones who are paying attention to certain things. And as long as you're not detracting for the others, then that's fine. You know?
Yeah. So this movie came out in 2003. And my understanding is that although you were probably only 19 years old, you were working around this time. I'm wondering if you have any memories of what the trends were in set design at the time, or trends in office, right? Like, were open concept offices more of a thing? And so composure is set up that way. Do you remember any of that? It was 20 years ago.
Yeah, I can honestly say I don't
remember
that. Although in 2003, I was doing the TV show Angel. I was designing that TV show. And we happened to do a big office for the bad guys, Wolfram and Hart, who were the bad guys on the show. We did a big sort of open style office design in part of it. But, you know, again, the world, when you saw it in like The Devil Wears Prada or shows like that, that are presenting, you know, those open designs, which became so popular back then, really touched a nerve because I think people were tired of being in cubicles. They were tired of being in four walls. They wanted to sort of, well, I want to come to work, but I sort of want to see my friends and I sort of want to be able to lean over my divider and talk to somebody and share a cup of coffee. I mean, there's a psychology to those kind of office spaces that goes well beyond my pea brain thinking. Now, the separate goes for, if you go back and look at the movie All the President's Men in the offices of the Washington Post, which was a very, very, very famous set that was built, you know, that was about the biggest office space you could imagine, but there was no individuality. It was just, it was a machine. It was one after the other, after the next, and everything looked exactly the same because that was part of that story. So in some respects, the same open office scenario can work for you and against you in a couple of different ways, or not necessarily against you. It can work for you in every way, but it could work sort of putting the viewer in a comfort zone, also putting the viewer in a kind of like, well, this isn't a world I belong in. I'm not part of this world, or I don't relate to this world. So all those conscious choices are just that. When I go scouting for locations, I'll say, well, let's look for an office. Well, not just any office will do. People say, well, here's a room with a bunch of desks. That's an office. Like, well, that's not an office. I mean, it's a room with a bunch of desks. If you are telling a story, you want to know whose characters inhabit that office. So a lot of thought goes into that. Or at least it's supposed to.
Was there anything in watching the movie, was there a production design element that surprised you that you were like, huh, good for you? Or like, that's not how I would have done that. I would have put the Knicks in a pink stadium.
I wasn't blown away by it. Again, this is a different period of time. I wasn't blown away by that big party
The Diamond Party.
The Diamond Party, yeah. I wasn't blown away by that. It seemed, for some reason to me, it seemed like they kind of cheaped out on that a little bit. It seemed a little thin.
I agree.
Yeah.
And like you don't really get a sense of the space.
Right.
There's like a cocktail hour room and then like a banquet room that for some reason Andy's allowed in before the doors are open for, like, it's empty. That space never really makes sense to me.
Right, exactly. For a movie that had gone above and beyond with a lot of great looks, and it's, you know, and being in New York, you know, and being able to sort of capture the city, that one seemed like an odd choice. So I'm not sure. You know, again, who knows? Did it come down to schedule availability of a room? Did they lose a location? Did they have to hastily put it together because actor availability changed? You kind of never know. And that's something as a designer you go through all the time. It's like, you know what? We need to rearrange this, 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 this. Literally right now as we speak, I just returned from the country of Colombia where we're going to be shooting in a couple of weeks. And one of the houses that we were going to be shooting in down there, they said, we need to build that back here and we need to shoot it in a couple of days. So my guys are downstairs right now taking one of our military hallway sets that we've had for 7 years and turn that into a Honduran favela shack. And that's the fun thing for me in design for television is the flexibility of how quickly things change and how quickly things turn on a dime. And you have to be very, very malleable and not so precious with your ideas, because if you get stuck being precious with your ideas, you're just going to be disappointed. And to me, it's like, you know what? Sure, we'll do it. We'll figure it out. Change it. Boom, boom, boom. You know, there's a million ways to skin a cat.
So my last question is just, are there any principles of set design that we should be watching for going forward? Are there like questions we should be asking ourselves while watching a movie in order to better evaluate production design?
Well, I think, honestly, you want the design to further the story, not have the story further the design. And so I would love people to say, boy, that your design stuff was gorgeous. That worked so well with the story. It never took me out of the story and made me question, okay, well, was that really just for design's sake or whatever? You know, you want to, again, know that you're furthering the story and helping to be one of the components that make it a fantastic experience. I'm not sure if that answers the question, but.
Absolutely, it did. Stuart, thank you so much. I'm so grateful. And I love learning about this stuff.
You are absolutely welcome. I'm happy to help you. You're doing God's work.
I really am. You know, we live in a world of chaos and I'm just here learning about rom-coms. You're welcome, everyone.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
So after looking closely at production design with Stuart, we are going to look closely at one specific scene as we make our way through the movie scene by scene. And so as always, we're going to call the brilliant Hannah Rehack. Hi, Hannah.
Hi.
So you and I both just watched the scene in which Ben makes a rack of lamb for Andy. This is day 4 and I think day 4 of their relationship. And Andy walks in to this apartment and she is laden with boxes to girlify this space. What did you notice about the scene?
Well, you're in my ear now. So the first thing I really noticed is just like, oh, Kate Hudson's being charming and funny. Like she's being so goofy. She's really giving a comedic performance. And also I'm so aware of how much the cringe has bothered me. So I move quickly from that and I'm trying to look otherwise, but it made me cringe. It's so uncomfortable.
It's so cringy. It's one of the cringiest scenes. It's one of the top 3 cringiest scenes.
It's so cringy because it's so over the top. Vanessa, you said girlify with the exact right intonation of like girlify. Is that what's like, are we going to go with that wording. And it's true. Like, that is right. That's the idea, is that she's adding pink to his space. She's adding stuffed animals. There's a feminine touch, so to speak, like across his apartment by the time he's done like ladling gravy on the food. And she's so like unabashedly taking up space. Her comfort with like dancing, singing, adding feminist icon musicians to his CD player is like so over the top that the cool girl in me cringes at the embarrassment of what she's doing. So I clocked that in a big way this time.
Yeah, I love that there are things about this moment where I am judging her. I'm like, okay, you've been on 4 dates, like respect his space.
Right, calm down.
You know, like regardless of any rules, it's just rude to invade someone's space in this way. But I love you pointing out that the like singing and the dancing, right? Like she's just taking up space in a way that I want women to feel comfortable doing. I don't think I want anyone to feel comfortable like going and changing all of my CDs. Yeah. But I do want women to be able to say, like, I don't like this music. Can we put on something else? Right. So there is something about this that's feminist, iconic, like loveliness.
I think the thing that came to mind for me in this scene the most was like, oh, right, he's also manipulating her. I think I really keep losing track of that in a big way because she, for all intents and purposes, she is the protagonist and he is the male co-lead. Like, but it is about like, it starts with her taking on this story.
Yeah.
And then we have the parallel story of him trying to make her fall in love with him. And I think I really lose sight of that because it feels like we're most often making fun of the ways in which she's trying to lose him. We're not really making fun of the ways that he is trying to make her fall in love with him.
Right.
So it's easy to kind of like lose track of that part of the facade, I think. And given that, if she wasn't doing her own sort of game, why wouldn't she add stuff to his apartment? He's manipulating her to fall in love with him. So like,
right.
I don't know that that's like totally unhinged if we were to take his behavior at face value, which is that he's falling in love with her and wants her to fall in love with him. Like he's doing that by design. So I really want to like try to be better at keeping that in front of mind that he's also playing a game, because I think I forget it. I think the movie kind of lets you forget it.
I think the movie lets you forget it. I think that that point really opened my eyes, because it seems to be that the supposition is that women are just ready to fall in love. And so the thing that he has to do to make her fall in love with him is just endure her.
Yeah.
And like not let her scare him off. And that women to some extent are just like predisposed to fall in love with any man who's willing to give them attention. So at every turn, all he's doing is enduring, right? Like he has designed this date tonight for himself. He wants to watch the game. He likes to eat rack of lamb. Mm-hmm. He hasn't asked her if she has any dietary restrictions, right? And I think he does like Sleepless in Seattle, and he doesn't like women who talk during the movie. And so he just doesn't snap at her while she's talking to him at the movie. And like, that's enough. I think that all he's doing in order to, quote unquote, make her fall in love with him is putting up with her. And that's supposed to be enough.
Yeah. The way in which she has to play it to lose him is so much more degrading than the way he has to elevate his own life to make her fall in love with him. I'm like, learn how to cook. Right. If it had been played that way, it's like, sure, learn how to cook. Learn how to clean the apartment. Learn how to plan a date. That's not degrading versus like, for her to play up the things that women do to lose men. It's like so cringy, embarrassing, over the top.
Yeah. The other thing that occurred to me, and I think that this is just going to occur to me scene by scene, is how well structured this movie is. He is looking at the lamb and he goes, oof, so perfectly pink, about this like kind of raw, right? Like medium rare flesh.
Yeah.
And like that's manly pink. And then it cuts to her like putting a pink fuzzy rug down in his bathroom. And so there's like manly cool pink and then femme not cool cringy pink. And I'm just like, God, like he says the word pink and then you see pink. Like it's just structured to within an inch of its life in the best way.
Yeah. Throughout the entire film, there's a lot of balance. Ironically, there's a lot of balance. Or by design. Maybe it's actually by design.
After talking to Stuart I was always struck in this scene without consciously being able to articulate it to myself, how ugly her stuff is in his apartment. And part of it is that it's like cheap crap that she's bringing over, right? It's not like it's a nice chenille blanket that makes you want to curl up in it. It like looks very like synthetic and gross. Like you really, it all looks like stuff that she like stopped by the 99 cent store and just like filled a bag with the most feminine stuff that she could find. And also like childish, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's multiple stuffed animals. It's not like this is her one lovey that she kept from childhood. It's like she is somebody who loves her stuffed animals so much she has to bring them to her new boyfriend's house on the fourth date. But, you know, there's a version of this that is like the pink pops against the blue and you know that it's out of sync with his apartment, but it's still aesthetically pretty and just like pleasing to your eye. This production intentionally makes her stuff look ugly. And it's so interesting, right? Because it's coming out of a scene where she looks so beautiful and she's in her office, which is so beautiful. And she's like basically having sex with a piece of meat. She's like biting into a big piece of meat and making all these groaning sounds. And so this movie obviously knows how to make a set look sumptuous and beautiful. And yeah, when the two of them are combining here, it looks synthetic and fake and ugly.
Yeah. For me, it's like, yeah, that's the high stakes of writing in the sense that it's like, that's obviously working in service of contrast to be like real Andy slash cool girl Andy likes me and, you know, is chic and makes a good living in the magazine world, evidently. So we want to see the contrast of like this character that she's playing. But then what you're suggesting is that like stereotypes around femininity are associated with like being childish, with being, I would say, sort of like suburban in a sense, like some of that you said, like those like cheap pieces of decor that like they have frills on that. It feels a little like country or like, I say this with like love in my heart and scare quotes, but like suburban mom vibes, right? Like that there's an element of like, yeah, not being very urban or worldly. And it's not a coherent stereotype because then the CDs that she's putting in are these like very beloved feminist, pretty like lesbian or lesbian coded or queer coded artists like Sinead O'Connor,
Tori Amos, Fiona Apple, Carly Simon, whoever picked these CDs or like these artists and whoever picked that she's going to be singing You're So Vain by Carly Simon.
And it's like, that's not one type of unattractive, quote unquote, unattractive woman to this man. That's like a couple different ones. That's like the overbearing mommy type. Then there's the feminist who like won't take any of his shit. And then there's the too deeply caring vegetarian LA, like California kind of like woo-woo version. Like there's—
And the little girl, she like does a baby voice. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just not one type of woman. So it's like pretty rude to a lot of different quote unquote types of women. It's interesting that he doesn't see it.
But it shows how good she is, right? That she's like, I will try every different stereotype to see which one is going to repulse you.
Yeah. Yeah, you're so right. And she's already tried a couple different ones. Like we've already seen the interruptive girl, right? Like she's doing that still. We've seen the pouty thing. I think you're right. I think it, in the spirit of talking about heightening, like as we move through the movie, she is throwing more things at the wall to be like, okay, what kind of woman is going to like totally turn him off? Little does she know and little do I remember. He's going to stick with it because he wants her to fall in love with him.
Yeah. And again, all it takes for her to fall in love with him from his point of view is sticking with it. Up.
Planning a date. Planning a single plan. And you know what? The bar is in hell, but I wouldn't say no to that. Someone cooking.
I know. Someone who's just like, whoever you are, I'm going to stick around. And like, you don't have to monitor yourself in theory, right? Like you can cry at the thought of murdering a lamb and then also need tampons. It sounds great.
My favorite moment from that whole scene, though, is when she's singing, when she goes, maybe Ben's partner, maybe Ben's partner. It's iconic. And I did not realize she was rewriting the lyrics. Like, as I've seen it, like as a kid or whatever, I was just like, oh, yeah, that scene where she like sings at him. And I'm like, oh, it's so over the top. It's so, for listeners, if I sound different, it's because I'm covering my cheeks and like, I'm appalled. I'm cringing. I'm blushing. I'm blushing on her behalf.
The one other thing that occurred to me is that she is able to get away with doing so many of these things without him noticing because he doesn't look at her when she comes in. I mean, he's cooking, and so you like feel for him a little bit. But he at no point looks up and is like, hi, and like kisses her hello or like asks, how was your day? Right. Like he is just totally absorbed in his single task and telling her like dinner in 5 minutes, game in 8 minutes. And like that's how she can get away with totally redecorating his apartment is because, yeah, he's like not actually acknowledging her as a human being.
Yeah, I read that in two different ways, and I'm not sure how and where I land on it. Is it that he's just following his guidebook of how he's going to make her fall in love with him, and so he has tasks and he's going to complete them, and that includes making her dinner and putting on a game? Or is it that we're supposed to understand where they're at in their relationship because it's a very efficient movie, as we've talked about, that like it is communicating, they're comfortable, she lets herself into his apartment, he can continue cooking for her, she can do what she's going to do. In this case, she's going to take advantage of it and make herself really comfortable. But I think it feels really different than the movie date, than the basketball date. It has a different quality to it, I guess, that shows a different kind of intimacy that they've reached in their 4 days of dating or 5 days of dating or whatever it is, without having sex, crucially without having sex.
And the only other thing we have to say is that the love fern arrives in this scene. And the love fern, which is a plant that she has brought over to his apartment. And for some reason, that's the thing that he notices at first. He's like, what's in the box? And she's like,
A plant.
But she says, a love fern. It's a baby, like our relationship. And it's important to note because that love fern is going to come back at least two more times. So,
yeah, big character reveal.
I wonder how they did that stunt casting, getting that plant to play the love fern. It's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a huge get. That fern's in Jurassic Park. It's amazing.
Hannah, thank you so much as always, and we will talk to you next episode.
Bye. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Hot and Bothered. We're a small show, so we need your support to run. If you can, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/hotandbotheredromcom. We are a Not Sorry production. Our executive producers are Caitlin Hoffmeister and me, Vanessa Zoltan. Our consulting producer is Russell Mayfe. We are edited and produced by Ariana Nettleman and distributed by Acast. Thanks as always to our soulmate-level patrons, Gretchen Sneegas, whose window we would hold up a boombox outside of, Molly Reilly, who we would chase through the airport to declare our love, Becky Boo, who we would wait for hours on the top of the Empire State Building for, Elizabeth Schweinsberg, who heart we would play for in a game of one-on-one basketball, and Claudia Hammerman, who we would give the whole door to float on, even if there was room for us both. A huge thanks this week to Stuart Blatt, a delight and brilliant designer. And to our team, as always, Julia Argy, Nikki Zoltan, AJ Aramas, Hannah Rehack, Margaret H. Wilson, Courtney Brown, Fedius Reyes, Casper Turkile, and Stephanie Paulsell.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.